How Harriet Tubman helped win the Civil War. How Florida, in the wake of South Florida tragedy, is improving its boating laws. And how our state's patriotism gets dissed. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with Miami native Etta Fields Black, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her history of Harriet Tubman and the pivotal Civil War raid on the Combahee River. We'll also examine Lucy's Law, a bill just passed by the Florida legislature to strengthen the state's boating codes after Luciana Fernandez's tragic death. And we'll look at how we measure patriotism and why Florida keeps finishing near the bottom in one patriotism survey. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. This is a weekend we honor those who've died serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, as well we should. But there have also been important, even critical, U.S. military actions in which, thankfully, no soldiers died. One that stands out is the Combahee River Raid of June 1, 1863 during the Civil War, a Union Army operation led in reality by a former enslaved African-American woman, Harriet Tubman. Its attack on several South Carolina rice plantations freed 756 enslaved people, the most ever in an action like that, and its success created momentum for the North just weeks before the war's turning point at the Battle of Gettysburg. Miami native Etta Fields Black just won the Pulitzer Prize for her history of that event, titled Combi, Harriet Tubman, the Combahee River Raid, and Black Freedom During the Civil War. Its account of the raid, and of its hero Tubman, who most people know as the leader of the Underground Railroad, is a rich and overdue addition to the Civil War saga. Joining me now is Etta Fields Black, a history professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, as well as her mother, Miami historian Dorothy Jenkins Fields, who is founder of the Black Archives History and Research Foundation of South Florida, home of the historic Lyric Theater. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you
for having us.
Etta, the fact that before your book, there were few, if any, substantive chronicles of the Combahee River Raid, and frankly, few really substantive biographies of Harriet Tubman. What kind of troubling void did that represent, not just for Civil War history, but 19th century American history in general, as far as you were concerned? Why was it so important to correct that?
Well, I thought it was important to tell this story because the Civil War was the least known moment in Harriet Tubman's legendary life. I wanted to understand not only more about Tubman's Civil War service and her leadership in the Combahee River Raid, but more about the people who were freed. I wanted to know more about the formerly enslaved people who were liberated in the raid and the formerly enslaved men who fought in the raid. Mm-hmm. And as a historian, it's very challenging to identify individual enslaved people and for historians of slavery to tell the history of slavery from the words and through the voices of enslaved people. Mm-hmm. But that's the story that I wanted to tell.
And the story's central character is Harriet Tubman, for whom Miami-Dade County recently renamed US 1, or what used to be called the Dixie Highway. She escaped to freedom as a young woman and used her keen sense of the country's landscape and its people to lead other slaves to freedom in the Underground Railroad. And then she used those skills as a valuable intelligence agent for the Union Army in the Civil War. But early in your book, Etta, you point out a pivotal irony in Tubman's story. She didn't seem to have any talents slaveholders wanted, so she was largely left alone and, quote, would be her own boss. How important was that to the heroism Tubman later displayed, do you think?
I think it was very important, and I think it was her first act of resistance to refuse to learn how to weave, to refuse to learn how to be a good house slave, both of which would have confined her to the house and to the close supervision of plantation mistresses And Tubman decided pretty early on that's not where she wanted to be. She preferred to be outside. She preferred to work among field hands and to work with her father and to have more autonomy. So I think that her not displaying the skills to do the indoor skilled labor, I think that was actually, those were acts of resistance. She didn't want to do it. She didn't want to be confined to the house. She didn't want to be under the thumb and under the watchful eye of the planters.
Now, I read in an earlier biography of Harriet Tubman that she once remarked, quote, "I don't know how to read books, but I know how to read people." Did that make her a better spy for the Union cause during the Civil War?
Absolutely, absolutely. Tubman could read people. She could also read the landscape.
And your book also makes the salient point that Tubman and the black soldiers of the 2nd South Carolina Infantry Regiment who carried out the Combahee River raid were among the few freed slaves who dared venture back into the South and risk that freedom. Just how big a risk were they taking?
Oh, the risks were enormous. On the one hand, they were risking their own freedom, and they were risking their lives. We know that they would have been re-enslaved. They were Confederate orders that if any black men were caught in U.S. Army uniform, that they would be re-enslaved. There was also the possibility that they could be hung. And I argue in Cumbie that for these people who had achieved their own freedom, had liberated themselves, being re-enslaved was a fate worse than death. Many would have died rather than be re-enslaved, yet they were willing to risk it all for the freedom of others.
Now, Edit, you do a masterful job weaving together all the characters and elements of the Combahee River raid, from Tubman to the seven white slaveholding families whose rice plantations were the operation's targets, from the all-black Union Army regiment that conducted the operation to the 756 enslaved people who were freed in it, from the Union officers to the Combahee River landscape itself. But this marked the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history. Why was it also so important to the Civil War fortunes of the North?
The Combahee River Raid was important to the North's Civil War fortunes because it was the beginning of a turning point. Shortly before the Battle at Gettysburg, as well as I show in Combahee a precursor to the Union retaking Charleston. Now, that was a long process, and it wouldn't happen for, many, many, many months to come. And there were many battles that would take place, some of which the Union lost badly. But this was sort of the first shot across the bow, was the Combahee. And if you think about the morale of the North, it was a small boost to Northern morale that they could get this close to where the first shots in the Civil War were fired.
Dorothy, I want to ask you here, as a pioneer of black history in Miami, what impressed you most about the black history epic your daughter Etta brought to life in this Pulitzer Prize-winning book?
Well, I am, of course, all about primary sources. And for her to be able to get those pension files from the National Archives, who, as I understand, had not been digitized before her request. And they're so voluminous and so detailed. And the fact that she just bit the bullet and went through them and put it together is just remarkable.
And along those lines, Dorothy, what did you sense in the book that Etta perhaps learned from watching you and your historian efforts when she was growing up? What techniques or sensitivities did you recognize and maybe took some pride in seeing in this book?
I think the best thing would be perseverance, that through many hardships and many mountains to climb, she saw me moving through and doing whatever needed to be done in order to make it happen. And that is to create an archive, a community repository, so that students and faculty and emerging scholars, as she was at the time, would have a chance to see the story and to tell it and share it with others.
And can both of you recount for me a phone call you mentioned to me, Dorothy, that Etta made to you when she was out doing research of the landscape there in South Carolina for the book, when she was out in the sort of the swampy area and apparently ran into an alligator. Can you both tell me about how that research moment played out in your phone call?
What time was that, Ed? About 4 o'clock in the morning?
No, I did not go out to the rice field at 4 a.m. I did go out to the grassy area at 4 a.m. outside. I was living on one of the Cumbie Raid plantations at the time. There were a lot of phone calls. I would routinely call mom from the rice field, and I routinely saw alligators.
Right.
Sometimes multiple alligators
Right.
swimming around as I hiked through the embankments in the rice
Well,
fields.
and on a more serious note, I bring that up because in your book, you point out that any enslaved person who was trying to escape the plantations in that area had to deal with those alligators to get to freedom, right?
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. I'm speaking with Miami native Etta Fields Black about her Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the pivotal Civil War raid on the Combahee River led by Harriet Tubman in 1863, and also with her mother, Miami historian Dorothy Jenkins Fields. Etta, you have another very personal stake in this history because one of the enslaved people in that Combahee River area was your great-great-great-grandfather, Hector Fields. Is this something that led you into your research on this book, or was it something you discovered in the research? How important did it make this historical endeavor to you?
Yeah, no, this was something I knew Hector Fields' name before I started Cumbie, and my cousins knew his name, but we didn't know his story. We didn't even know that he was a U.S. Colored Troop veteran who fought during the Civil War.
And he was in that South Carolina 2nd Regiment, right? The all black
He
regiment.
enlisted in the 2nd South Carolina in March of 1863. And was in one of the regiments that fought in the raid and was actually on the gunboat, the John Adams, with Harriet Tubman that went up to Cumbie Ferry. I didn't know any of this. I knew that my father was the last of his siblings to be born a mile or two from where the raid took place. And I was entrusted with, I call it the family business, really restoring our sacred family cemetery, where the Fields family is buried in unmarked graves on a rice plantation in the Cumbie area. And I was separately, did not know and connected at all, but looking for Hector Fields and his descendants and trying to put together the pieces of who was buried in that cemetery.
Right.
And this is how I found out that Hector was a Civil War veteran. Was able to acquire his pension file, which did not have much information at all,
Right.
but able to find out that he had a brother, Jonas Fields, who did have a pension file, which shed a lot of light on Hector's life as well as the rest of the Fields family.
Well, that's a really rich element to this. Dorothy, since this is Memorial Day, I also wanted to ask you about the importance of the Black history effort here when it comes to accounting for African American servicemen and women, such as those from Miami and South Florida, for example, who we know were part of the famous Tuskegee Airmen in World War II.
Well, starting in World War I, many of the, in fact, all of the young men who were in Black young men from this area went to Tuskegee to get their training. But before that, they signed up right here in Miami's Color Town, and the person who signed them up was D.A. Dorsey. D.A. Dorsey was very active in every part of the community. And so those who qualified were signed up here, and then they went to Tuskegee,
Right.
where they were trained and then sent overseas or whatever. It's through the obituaries in particular and the church programs that we know about them, that we are able to follow them and to see what they did in the community. And so the obituaries are very, very important to our collection.
Etta, I also can't read a book about Harriet Tubman and the Combahee River Raid these days without being reminded of some of the efforts that have been made in your home state of Florida in recent years to revise the history of slavery in the United States. As a historian and a Black Floridian, how has that affected you? And just as important, how do you feel books like yours are an antidote for it?
Well, I definitely think that Cumbie is an antidote. One of the things, as I've mentioned, that was very important to me was to document the lives of the enslaved people and to tell their stories of bondage in their own words. So in the Pynchon Files, people talk about what it was like to be enslaved on the rice plantations, to work in these very deadly environments, particularly for women, talking about the deaths of their children because of chronic malaria, because the children were born, because the mothers had chronic malaria. And when the children were born, they failed to thrive. So I wanted to tell the story of slavery and freedom from the perspective of the enslaved people. And I think that really is the antidote to so many claims that have been made recently of slavery not existing, of slavery not being as harsh as some would have you to believe, of enslaved people benefiting from their bondage. You know, the rice planters in coastal South Carolina were the wealthiest in British North America up until the Revolutionary War. And one of them whose, well, his plantations were north. They were along the Cumbie, but they were on the northern Cumbie. He was the wealthiest planter and the largest slaveholder in the U.S. South up until his death in 1851.
Right.
So it was the exploitation of enslaved people's skills and labors and bodies that created this wealth, and they didn't share in any of it. So I think that Cumbie shows that in very rich detail and also provides the documentation, which is irrefutable.
Dorothy, in the minute we just have left, let me ask you the same question. As an important Black historian here in Miami and Florida, how do you confront that concern that in the current American environment, when we look, for example, at the historical revisionism going on at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, there is perhaps an effort afoot to rewrite or at least soften certain troubling facets of our history, like slavery, and to downplay the role of figures like Harriet Tubman? How do you confront that?
Well, that's why the documents are so important. It's so important that we have them, that we copy them, that we make them available to those who are writing the history, so that the history, the true history, can be told. The people left documents. That's what gets me so excited about archive. That there are things left for us. There's a path for us. We just have to follow it. The evidence is there through the documents.
Dorothy Jenkins Fields is founder of the Black Archives History and Research Foundation of South Florida. Her daughter, Etta Fields Black, is author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning history, Combahee, Harriet Tubman, the Combahee River Raid, and Black Freedom During the Civil War. Many thanks to you both.
Thank
you. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, Florida, in the wake of a South Florida tragedy, tries to strengthen its boater safety laws. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. It's Memorial Day weekend, the kickoff of summer, and in South Florida that means a lot of boating. But several recent tragedies have reminded us of the need to strengthen, if not overhaul, our boating laws. Perhaps no incident has raised that flag more disturbingly than a deadly September 2022 accident on Biscayne Bay that killed a teenage girl. It resulted in vessel homicide charges against a prominent Coral Gables real estate broker and angry controversy over its handling by state law enforcement. So, not surprisingly, a bill that just passed the Florida legislature that would toughen the state's boating codes is called Lucy's Law, after Luciana Fernandez, the girl who died in that 2022 crash. Governor DeSantis is expected to sign the measure into law, but there are already questions about whether it goes far enough on issues like sobriety tests for boat drivers. And those are questions we should be asking on a heavy boating weekend like this one. Joining me now to ask them is David Goodhue, a reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, who's done stellar coverage on both the 2022 Biscayne Bay tragedy and Florida's boating reform efforts. David, it's always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What important reforms did get into this bill the legislature just passed? I know it raises penalties for boaters involved in serious crashes, but what stands out to you in terms of how this brings boating laws more in line with automobile laws, for example? You and I have talked in the past on this show about how comparatively lax the former often appear compared with the latter here.
The main thrust of this law brings reckless boating up to par with reckless driving, whereas before, if you seriously injured somebody in a boating accident, it was a misdemeanor. Now Right. It's a felony.
Right. And I remember in the 2022 accident that involved that Coral Gables real estate broker, George Pino, who will soon go on trial for that tragedy. Now, it was originally going to be just a misdemeanor in that case, correct?
Correct.
But now he is facing felony vessel homicide charges.
Yes, that resulted after more witnesses came forward who were never interviewed before by police. We interviewed those people. And as a result of some of our articles and another witness, a firefighter who was on scene that day, came forward, a state attorney's office reopened their investigation, resulting in the reckless boating charge, which is basically vessel homicide.
Right. So now under this bill, these kinds of incidents would be taken much more seriously in terms of the likelihood of a felony charge instead of just an automatic misdemeanor.
Correct. For instance, in order for the state attorney's office to upcharge Pino with the felony, they had to do some dealings with the family of the girl who was seriously injured, Katerina Puig. Since there was no felony charge for reckless boating that resulted in serious injury, because she's very seriously injured, remains so to this day.
Right.
That family had to agree to drop their careless boating charge against George Pino in order for them to come back with the reckless boating that resulted in a death.
Right. Okay. And so this new bill addresses that. That's an interesting context. Thanks. But your reporting, David, has also pointed out what did not get into this bill that many feel should have. Like, as I mentioned earlier, mandatory sobriety tests for boaters involved in serious accidents like this. What were some other noticeable omissions?
The big one that they tried for, but it got taken out when the these things become horse trading exercises, was boater education. The current law is that anybody born on or after January 1st, 1988 has to take a boater safety class and has to have a certification on them while they're on a vessel to show that they completed that course. The way Lucy's Law was originally written, it would mandate that anyone living in Florida for less than 5 consecutive years, no matter how old they were, would have to take the same course. And that was taken out in the 11th hour.
Really? Why would that not have made it into the final measure?
Probably because the boater lobby is just too strong in Florida, and that was too controversial. It was a bridge too far for them.
Interesting. Are these the sorts of items that folks believe could be included in future boating legislation? Or to put it another way, is there a feeling that this bill was sort of a testing the waters effort, forgive the pun, that will likely lead to stronger measures later on?
Perhaps, because I don't think if it was not for the Fernandez's, Lucy's parents, their persistence, this would have gotten passed at all, because, boating is so huge in Florida. It's a lifeblood of the state economy. And the lobby for the boating industry, for the various aspects of the boating industry, is very strong. So the fact that anything stronger that strengthened voting laws got passed was pretty surprising.
Right. So we should probably expect this to be sort of an incremental phenomenon more than anything else.
Yes.
Okay. Now, as we said, this bill is called Lucy's Law for Luciana Fernandez. She was the 17-year-old high school senior at Our Lady of Lourdes Academy who was killed in 2022 when the boat being driven by Coral Gables real estate broker George Pino crashed into a channel marker, throwing Lucy and 11 other girls who were celebrating Pino's daughter's birthday into the water. What was it about that accident, especially the controversial, if not derelict, way it was allegedly handled by state police and investigators, that led to passage of Lucy's Law this month in the legislature?
I mean, when you even take out the aspect of how the investigation was handled, it was such a tragedy, not only with Lucy dying, but with Caddy Puig's injuries. I mean, here is a girl who was heading for probably Division I college soccer prospects, mm-hmm. star standout Our Lady of Lourdes soccer player. The fact that all these girls were friends, the fact that these families were tight, it was just a tragedy all around. It strained, broke relationships. And then, of course, the way the investigation played out was shocked everybody because everyone was under the impression that there was a rigorous investigation underway, and it turned out that was not the fact.
And what about the aspect of George Pino's alleged conduct as the boat driver? How was that also a factor in sort of being an impetus for this legislation?
Well, it was a major driver. Because first of all, even the investigation showed that, I mean, the GPS track, this is not a narrow channel that they were in. He was hugging the left side, which is like almost like driving on the wrong side of the road, right next to all these fixed channel markers. He's going in the 40s in his boat and on the water. That's very fast. I mean, 45 miles per hour doesn't seem fast in the car, but in the water, it's very fast.
Yeah.
And then the last minute, right before impact of this channel marker that he ends up hitting, he guns it up to almost 50 miles per hour. Then there's a whole aspect of maybe it was the boat overloaded and he had 14 people on a 29-foot boat. The drinking in the end was not a factor in anything because they didn't test him for alcohol that night, and you can't get someone on boating under the influence or driving under the influence after the fact. I mean, if you never tested them to begin with, if you never equalized them, field sobriety test, drew blood, you know, 2 days yeah. later, it's late, and that's when they found all the empty alcohol containers on his boat was, you know, yeah. a day or two when they pulled it out of the water.
Which brings us to the question, does this bill address the kind of police and investigative mishandling of this case, especially when it came to Pino's alleged alcohol consumption that you just mentioned? Does it do that strongly enough to make sure that that kind of alleged investigative dysfunction doesn't happen again?
Not completely. I mean, it does up the penalties for, you know, if injuring somebody if you were intoxicated, but it doesn't have anything in there about testing people for alcohol. And at the same time, another boating bill passed, I think Boater Freedom Initiative, or that where police can't just come up to police right now can come up to your boat and do a safety check for you, life jackets, flares, what have you. And that's oftentimes when they discover a boat operator is impaired, but police now have to have probable cause before they go up to your boat.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's David Goodhue about Florida's efforts to reform its boating safety laws in the wake of recent tragedies in waters like Biscayne Bay. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. David, I want to step back for a second and look at the larger picture of the boating culture and the culture of boating safety in Florida, especially South Florida. You know the water scene in the Keys and Biscayne Bay as well as any journalist. So when we come to a weekend like this one, what concerns you most about what's going on out there? I know, for example, we've talked before on this program about the need for better boater education, which you just mentioned earlier could have been in this bill, but wasn't in this new bill. Again, bringing boater safety in line with car driver safety.
I think a lot of people would just be surprised that you do not need a license to drive a boat. You can buy a boat for tens of thousands of dollars that has a powerful or multiple powerful outboard engines on it, put it in the water and go ahead and drive. And I think people would be very surprised with that because, you know, operating a boat is very difficult. I would posit that it's even more difficult to drive than a car because for the simple fact that you can't stop a boat if there's no brakes
right.
in a boat.
And a 16-year-old kid has to go through driver's ed to drive a car, but a person over 37 right now does not have to take the same kind of training to drive a boat.
Correct. But even the boater education for the younger people, it's not weeks or months of driving a boat before you can get your license. It's that you passed a boater safety course. It's not really a, it's not really an instructional curriculum.
Do boating safety experts feel at the same time that South Florida's waters have simply become too boat congested, especially at holidays like this? And if so, what do they suggest needs to be done to make the traffic more manageable and safer? And what do we need to know about how the boating industry feels about some of these suggestions? As you mentioned earlier, the boating lobby is wary of a lot of these measures.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were saying that COVID, when people were stuck in their homes and, you know, couldn't really go out that much, but a lot more people bought boats. So the waterway has gotten more congested. Same time, these boats are becoming more powerful. You have multi-engine, multi-horsepower boats out there that go very, very fast, very powerful. That's a concern. And just, again, the lack of training that these new boater operators have when they're out on the water, and the drinking. It's not illegal to drink on your boat. It's not like with open container laws and a lot of other places that people congregate, you know, it's perfectly legal for everybody on the boat to be having a beer, which, you know, not judging that, but that also makes it more difficult for, it's not like a car. If a police officer stops your car and people in the back seat are having a beer, that's an open container. They can't do that, but they can do that.
Excellent point. Back to Lucy's Law, David. I know Lucy Fernandez's parents, Melissa and Andy Fernandez, wrote an op-ed in the Miami Herald earlier this year urging Florida lawmakers to pursue this bill. Here's what Melissa Fernandez told Local News 10 after its passage.
It was just completely overwhelming and humbling in such a positive way.
Do we know if they're satisfied and happy with the end result of the legislation? And what do they want us to remember most about their daughter, who, as I mentioned, was a senior at Our Lady of Lourdes Academy in Miami?
They are satisfied with the law. I mean, of course, you know, nothing's perfect, but the fact that it got passed makes them very happy, because there was, you know how the legislature is. There were moments where it didn't look promising.
Really?
The reason what they want you to remember about Lucy is also part of, they have a boater safety foundation that they found in her name, and she loved boating. She loved the water. They're a boating family.
Yeah,
they still are. And that's what she loved. She always loved the water. And that's what they want you to remember, how much she loved it. But also, you have to be safe out there, because it's a very enjoyable experience. You know, it's why people come to Florida. Yeah. But it can be deadly in a matter of a second.
Finally, David, update us on where the trial of George Pino stands at this point, particularly one of the most recent reports you've done on this, which was admittedly astonishing, that a state police officer said he deleted the body cam footage from the scene of that 2022 crash because he felt it was, quote, just a boating accident.
Yeah, he thought that at the time when he was submitting his body camera footage. The trial was scheduled to go in July, but I think it's going to be more in the fall. With the body camera footage, it wasn't just that officer, it was at least one other. And they labeled their body cam footage, quote unquote, incidental, which means that when you put it in the system, after 90 days, it goes away. You could label it misdemeanor or felony, and then it stays. I think misdemeanor stays like 5 years, felony doesn't go away.
Okay.
But there's a big question that, you know, the officers who did this were rank and file patrol officers, but there was a detective. FWC calls them investigators. That's the rank. It's not detective.
FWC
in that
meaning Fish and Wildlife
Fish
Commission.
Fish and Wildlife, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is the sort of thing, then, that we're hoping Lucy's Law will address in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a preservation of evidence that didn't happen.
Right. David Goodhue is a reporter with the Miami Herald. David, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, is Florida a patriotic state? That might be up for debate. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Memorial Day, like the 4th of July or Veterans Day, is one of those moments when we put out the American flags and we ask, what constitutes patriotism? How do we measure patriotism? And we here can't help notice that in recent years, the Miami-based personal finance firm WalletHub has issued, among its wide array of data surveys of American life, a ranking of the most patriotic states. And Florida regularly gets pegged among the least patriotic. And so, of course, we ask, why? WalletHub, and we acknowledge its surveys are not the most scientifically rigorous, uses what it calls both military engagement and civic engagement to tally each state's patriotism score. We're expecting this year's listing out soon, but last year, Florida ranked 46th, meaning it was the country's fifth least patriotic state. Virginia, if you're wondering, was the most patriotic state. But is this an accurate or fair assessment of patriotism? Joining me now to delve into that question is Mariana Mancuso. She's an editorial board member and columnist for our news partner, the Miami Herald. And she's also a former Florida Republican Party strategist who has spent her share of time listening to what people here in the Sunshine State define as patriotism. Mariana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
Now, I can't imagine anyone in Florida, Republican or Democrat, agreeing with WalletHub's conclusion that we rank 46th out of the 50 U.S. states in patriotism. One of the measures, for example, is the number of a state's military veterans per 1,000 adults. Florida has the third highest number of military veterans in the country. Many of them come here to retire. But either way, what's your initial reaction when you look at this WalletHub survey and see how low it places Florida patriotism-wise?
Tim, I have to be honest with you. When I was reading the survey and I saw that Florida ranked fifth, I literally clutched my pearls and gasped. I couldn't believe it.
The fifth least patriotic.
I was shocked because had you asked me just in conversation where would you rank Florida, I would have put it at least in the top five. I didn't think it'd be at the bottom five. So that was really surprising to hear.
Right. So let's look a little closer at the criteria used for these rankings. As I mentioned, the two biggest are military engagement and civic engagement. On the one hand, for example, the number of enlisted military and veterans per capita in a state. On the other hand, for example, the share of adults who voted in the last presidential election or U.S. history and civics education requirements. Are military service and voting that critical to how we measure or should measure a community's or an individual's patriotism, do you think?
Well, I think WalletHub definitely wanted to be able to nail down some metrics, and I think that that's a great starting point. But I think when it comes to patriotism, it seems as though it's more of a feeling, right? Like we feel very patriotic, and there are things that we do to express that level of patriotism, whether it is serve our nation abroad in the armed services or if we are, you know, registered to vote and showing up. As you mentioned in the previous election in 2024, in the presidential, we saw voter turnout for Florida was 78%.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
And I think it was 75% in the 2020. So that's, again, where I look at this and I say, how do we get ranked so low?
I have no idea, but I was, as again, I'm still surprised. We talked about this last week, and I'm still shocked. It's literally carrying over into the week as we head into Memorial Day. And, you know, I think that when we look to the patriotism level, it's more of a feeling. But as I was mentioning, WalletHub really needed to be able to nail down some metrics. And when it comes to serving our nation, you know, I think that that's a really great start, but I do think it's more of a feeling.
Yeah. One of the, I remember one of the criteria they have is how many people are involved in AmeriCorps as volunteers, for example. It seems to me that that opens the box to a lot of different interpretations of what a patriotic activity or contribution would be, no?
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with that. And I think that they really need some level of metric. When we think about patriotism, I know that from my perspective, I've always felt it to be about freedom and opportunity that we have in this country. And that's why I love this country.
Right.
I think
running a successful business could be a measure of patriotism.
Absolutely.
Because you're creating jobs.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Being a great teacher would be a form of patriotism, I would think. But let's focus in a little more on Florida itself then. Again, if military engagement and civic engagement are the two major criteria of this WalletHub patriotism ranking, you'd think Florida would rank much higher than 46 out of 50 states when you consider, as we mentioned, we have the third highest number of military veterans living here. And also when you consider that we've had more than 75% voter turnout in the last two presidential elections. So what could be dragging us down, do you think?
You know, I sometimes wonder that myself. Maybe it was voter registration, but that doesn't seem plausible because we're seeing massive numbers of voters registering mm-hmm. to vote, whether they're registering as Republican, which Republicans have recently crossed a threshold of voters in the state of Florida, or they're registering as Democrats. I think that civic engagement is so important. You know, when I was an adjunct professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University, I taught Freedom in American Society. Hmm. And one of the things that I really impressed upon my students was civic engagement.
Yeah.
And I encouraged them to show up and vote and register and make sure that all their friends were registered. And I think that that was an act of patriotism. And then, you know, lastly, is the level of patriotism considered if we're carrying around our Declaration of Independence and Constitution with us?
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on who you ask, I guess.
And when we talk about military service, I mean, you know, you look around the world, a lot of countries require military service. We don't here in this country, let's say for people who want to downplay the military, I would think that a person who does enlist in the military as a volunteer, you know, when you consider that a lot of other countries require it, that kind of raises the patriotic standing of that act, does it not?
No, I would completely agree. And it's also worth noting that in Florida, we have 24 active military bases. That seems like a lot, especially for given how large the state is. And I think that anytime somebody enlists in the military and decides to serve our country in the armed forces is definitely a duty and an act of patriotism for this country.
But, you know, on the military engagement side, I know Wallet Hub also considers a state's average number of current military enlistees then. Does Florida maybe have a lower number of adults currently serving in the military, for example? I mean, we've got Eglin Air Force Base, for example, up in the Panhandle, but could it be a situation where we have a lot of military veterans, especially those who retire here, but maybe not as many enlisted as maybe some other states like Virginia have?
I would have to probably agree with that. That might be the hook, is the fact that we don't have as many people heading down to the recruitment centers as other states such as Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that might be one of those things for sure.
On the civic engagement side, I mentioned before criteria like history and other civic education requirements. Is Florida perhaps apparently not as rigorous on that scale, as compared to a state like Virginia? It's hard to measure, though, isn't it?
It is. It's very hard to measure. I mean, how do you measure success of civics in schools? Is it how many people get out of high school and are registered to vote out of the gate? You know, how are we measuring that? What does that look like? Is that standardized testing? Is that the FCATs here in Florida?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure, because I think that when it comes to civics, I might be an anomaly, but when I was in high school and I took my government class, I came out more proud of being an American and had a deeper understanding of how the government and the country ran.
And as far as I know, Florida schools do have history and civics course requirements, no?
They do. And, you know, when I was teaching at Palm Beach Atlantic University, the capstone class that I was teaching, Freedom in American Society, was a required course of any student who came to Palm Beach Atlantic.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Mariana Mancuso about what defines patriotism and whether it's accurate or fair that Florida, at least in some recent surveys, ranks near the bottom in that category. So in the larger picture, Mariana, one could imagine Wallet Hub uses the military civic engagement bifurcation in its survey as a way of pleasing both Republicans, who might tend to view military service as a stronger gauge of patriotism, and Democrats, who might tend to view civic participation as the benchmark. But do you think there's maybe a red-blue divide there when it comes to patriotism?
I don't think either party has ownership of patriotism.
Nor do I.
I think that, you know, it's equally applied across the board. And we did see that, you know, we saw that in the 2024 election, both candidates running, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, embraced patriotism, and they showed it in various ways. Donald Trump supporters were wearing MAGA hats and they were waving the flag, while at the Kamala Harris rallies, you had them wearing the camo Waltz Harris hats.
Right.
And we also saw her campaigning with Republicans at where the Republican Party was born in Pennsylvania.
But along those lines, let's consider the civic education yardstick and that age-old debate about whether criticizing your country can be just as patriotic as praising it. And I mention that in the Florida context because this is certainly a red state today. I think we can all agree. And I can perhaps imagine people who do patriotism surveys maybe scrutinizing Florida because of, for example, accusations that Governor DeSantis and his administration have tried to block certain discussion about America's past in the state's school classrooms, things like slavery and racism or U.S. interventionism in Latin America, for example. So I guess I'm asking, Mariana, can patriotism that turns a blind eye to our country's flaws in the end be unpatriotic?
I think that that's a very fair question to ask. And I think that we kind of have to step back and look at different ways this country has dealt with that. For example, during the Vietnam era, we saw that Richard Nixon came under very crucial criticism for how he was handling the war. And then he invites Johnny Cash, a country music singer, to the White House to perform with that in the backdrop of protesters in the streets protesting Richard Nixon and his decisions and how he's handling the Vietnam War. And I think that this shows two men who loved this country very deeply, but they were able to disagree on policy and various stances when it came to politics.
Right. I remember, you know, I was a kid back then, and I remember one of the mottos, you know, of the, say, the more patriotic crowd was America, love it or leave it. And but then on the other side, they were saying, no, I'm expressing my patriotism by criticizing what's happening. But at the same time, we can and should, of course, turn the tables and make the same suggestion about liberals and how efforts they champion, like DEI or diversity, equity and inclusion, have gone off the rails too, right? I mean, liberals might think they're being patriotic by demanding that America progress, but it seems pretty unpatriotic in a democracy like ours for, say, a university to suppress conservative ideas, which is what elite schools like Harvard are being widely accused of these days themselves, no?
They are, absolutely. And I wrote a column for the Miami Herald about how it's great to see Republicans getting positions in universities here in Florida. Mm-hmm. So they're having a seat at the table and they're actually able to steer the education toward the center. And I think that when we think about DEI and we think about things that the left is wanting to encapsulate in our country and in the fabric, I think what's important is that they're not doing it from a malicious standpoint. Their intentions aren't nefarious. They love this country and this is how they think is appropriate. And I think the best thing about America is we have the ability to disagree.
Well, but as I mentioned, though, I would agree with you, DEI in and of itself per se is not a bad thing. But as I mentioned, in many ways, I think people feel that it went off the rails in terms of it morphed into a sort of a campaign to suppress conservative ideas in institutions like our universities. Is it fair to say that that in and of itself can be unpatriotic when we're talking about how a democracy should function?
I think in the terms of how a democracy should function, I think that the ability to have the freedom to express ourselves and to be able to say those things, I think all voices deserve a seat at the table.
Now, in your work as a political strategist, Mariana, what was your sense of what people, Floridians in particular, consider to be the key measures or measure of patriotism?
I think that's a very interesting question because as my work as a political strategist, I spent a very long time on the campaign trail for various candidates and campaigns across the entire state of Florida. And, you know, one of my favorite things about being part of a campaign during that time was being able to see how much people loved their candidates, how much the candidates loved the state and the country, and how energized the electorate was to turn out and elect this principled leader to office. And I just think that that's fantastic.
But in a place like Florida, on patriotic holidays like this one, what do people need to appreciate or respect about each other's definitions of what patriotism is in ways that might help us reduce the heavy polarization we're living with in America today?
That is a very good question, Tim. And, you know, I think that when we think about the polarization, I think the biggest issue that we have as Americans is understanding that we're all coming from a place of loving this country and wanting to do the right thing and to ensure that the great experiment continues on. I think also it's important for us to take a pause and recognize and give thanks to the service members' families whose service members paid the ultimate sacrifice.
Exactly. And I should point out, finally, a couple years ago, Florida ranked 47th. In the Wallet Hub Patriotism Survey. Now we rank 46, so maybe are we on the right track?
I think so. We're moving up.
Okay. Mariana Mancuso is an editorial board member and columnist for the Miami Herald. Mariana, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, this Memorial Day, we'd like to take a moment to recognize the work our community does to help and honor veterans for their service to the country. Miami Beach Veterans of Foreign Wars, or VFW, Post 3559, has long served veterans who are facing post-war readjustment to civilian life. They also have a campaign to preserve the historic veterans' headstones at the Miami City Cemetery. Alexander Kruger de Brota is the Miami Beach VFW Senior Vice Commander. He served two deployments in Afghanistan, and today he plants flags in the cemetery every Memorial Day, as he told local CBS News 4 last year.
I don't see any other reason to celebrate besides honoring those who gave everything to sacrifice. You learn the value of life. The people that gave it all, they did that so that we can enjoy our life.
This weekend, VFW is hosting a Memorial Day Remembrance Flag Garden display at Loomis Park in Miami Beach. There will be 3,000 flags representing the South Floridians who have made the ultimate sacrifice since the Revolutionary War. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.